I am Elle Penelope, author of epic fantasy and paranormal romance, and welcome to My Imaginary Friends, a look behind the scenes of an author mapping the worlds in my head and making them a reality. Hello, friends. Today is Saturday, December 28th, 2019, and this is episode 47 of My Imaginary Friends. I'm Leslie. So originally, this was going to be my 2019 wrap-up, but then the RWA, the Romance Writers of America, sort of imploded around the Christmas holiday. And so I decided to do a double episode because I wanted to share my thoughts about RWA and also do my 2019 wrap-up. So this is going to be one of two episodes so that I don't have to subject you to however long it would be if I combined them. So if you don't know about what happened with RWA over Christmas, then God bless you, because you are probably much happier for it. And if you just want to skip this episode and go on to the 2019 wrap-up, I will totally understand. It is a lot. I don't want to spend the entire episode recapping everything, because things have been moving really quickly, and by the time I finish recording, something could have changed. So I have some links in the show notes that do a good job of going over what happened. I'll do some recapping, but if you want to dig deep and do a deep dive, then check those out. The author Claire Ryan has been doing a great job of keeping her blog post up to date with the newest details. And yeah, what I want to talk about first is racism. I've talked about the RWA before on this podcast, and specifically the Rita Awards, and there have been systemic issues with racism and discrimination, homophobia, et cetera, in this organization, to the point where, until this year, no Black woman had ever won the highest award that we give out, the Rita Award. This year, 2019, two Black women won. So about that time when there were a lot of discussions going on about the Rita, I posted in a Facebook group in response to a post by an author who had said something like, why can't we just kick all the racists out of RWA? And my response was, well, who decides who's racist? And do we want those people to make those determinations? The example that I gave was, I have said to people in public places that I basically, with a few exceptions, I don't read books by white men, which is a flip way of saying that I just prioritize other kinds of authors in my reading. Now, someone could take that statement and call it reverse racism. And if there was some sort of law or way to kick all of the racists out of RWA, my point was that they could use a reverse racism argument against me, and somebody would find it valid. So, yes, to scrub an organization clean is a lofty goal, but one that we should be really wary of, because we see the rules that we put in place to protect people, to protect marginalized people, get turned around and used against us. And when all of this happened with RWA, which I will go over momentarily, that author in that forum responded to that post, basically saying, oh, yeah, you kind of called it on the reverse racism thing. And it seemed pretty clear to me at the time, and even now, there's a concept called same energy, and this is just an example of that same energy, that they're going to twist it potentially and use it against you. So what happened the day before Christmas Eve? And I will be as brief as I can. This is my understanding of what happened, and I will try to be accurate, but it's a lot. Again, if you check the links for more information, but what happened was that the day before Christmas Eve, it became public that RWA had suspended author Courtney Milan for an ethics violation. And she was suspended for a year, I believe, and had a lifetime ban on serving on the board or any officer position. I believe it was the next day or the day after they rescinded that ban because of the public outcry. Now, there were two people who filed ethics complaints against her, essentially for dragging a book on Twitter. There's a book that she was commenting on. She called it a fucking racist mess. She posted quotes from the book, and this was the basis of the ethics complaint against her. Now, I should mention that at the time, Courtney Milan was the chairman of the ethics committee. So when the complaint came in, she was asked not to recuse herself, but to resign her position, which she did. The ethics committee that she had been the chair of was not the committee that listened to the complaint and deliberated on it. Someone, and we don't know who at this point in time, formed a separate, secret ethics committee to listen to this complaint. And apparently that committee unanimously voted to suspend her. They found her in violation of one of the provisions, and they made the recommendation to the board. The board voted to accept the ethics committee's recommendation. It is still an open question as to whether they saw the initial complaint or whether they just saw the ethics committee's report. So there are a lot of things that we don't know at this point in time that we might not ever know, because there are rules in place that prohibit board members from talking about what happens in their meetings. So there's just speculation that they, based on what happened later and based on the makeup of the board, that it's possible that they didn't see the initial complaint, which you can read. Regardless, they initially voted to accept the ethics committee's findings, and then a day or two later rescinded that acceptance. And then a total at this point of 9 board members out of 16 resigned from the board. So when people found out that Courtney Milan, who was a former board member herself, in addition to being the chair of the ethics committee, had been suspended from the organization after receiving a service award last year. And the reason for her suspension was because she called out a book that she felt was racist on Twitter. The world exploded. And by the world, I mean the romance world. So this is what the ethics committee found her in violation of. The organization's expressed purpose of creating a, quote, safe and respectful environment for its community of writers. They cited invidious discrimination, which is defined as word or deed likely to arouse, inflame, or incur resentment or anger in others, tending to cause discontent, animosity, envy. Words that created an unjust comparison or were unfairly discriminating. Out of the 4 things that the people who filed the complaint were complaining about, this is the one that they found her in violation of. I have been calling this the Be Nice to People clause. And so that is the genesis of the implosion of the organization. There were 2 people who filed the ethics violation. One is the author of the book that Courtney was critiquing, let's say, on Twitter. And the other is the owner of a small press who hires that author as an editor. We all know that there's systemic racism in the publishing industry. So let's do a little hypothetical. Let's say that there is an editor, a very well-known editor at a New York publishing house, who, for example, receives a manuscript submitted to them that has a Black hero and heroine, and they are professional people, maybe they're doctors or lawyers, highly educated. And this editor, who is white, feels that these characters aren't authentic, that they shouldn't have those jobs, that they shouldn't speak so well. Can you put them in the hood? Can you make them speak with Ebonics, maybe? No? Oh, I don't think this manuscript is for us. I just don't find it authentic. And so the manuscript is rejected. Let's say that that editor, at some point in time, that editor loses their job at this New York publishing house and is then hired by a small press. When the owner of that small press is alerted to the racist behavior that this editor has exhibited in the past, alerted by several people, the owner of the small press responds that no one presented any definitive proof of racism by this editor. I would ask, how do you present definitive proof that your manuscript was rejected because of racism? Should authors have stenographers following them, recording every conversation they have? Should they illegally record telephone conversations before they know what's even going to be said in them? I don't know how this information was conveyed to the authors, and I don't know how you would definitively prove that your manuscript was rejected because of racism. There are all kinds of code words that are used. So let's say the owner of this small press got dragged in various mediums for her statements in support of this author, of this editor. And people looked a little bit more closely at the other editors at this small press, one of whom is an author who wrote a book that was then called A Fucking Racist Mess. Then the owner of the small press and the author of the book file ethics complaints against one of the authors who had been discussing the book on social media. So what is a safe and respectful environment? And how should that be created? I think these are important questions. As of last night, the current president of RWA, who was president after the former president resigned this week, made a statement indicating what I thought from the beginning, which was basically that the ethics committee followed the letter of the law. And in finding against Courtney, because I guess they're saying that she violated the bylaw about word or deed likely to arouse, inflame, or incur resentment or anger in others, the be nice to people clause she violated, because she was calling out something that she, as a woman of color, felt was very harmful, was perpetuating harmful stereotypes in this book. And she called it out very vociferously, as is her way. The current president said that they deliberated very diligently and they have to apply the ethics code no matter what. Only problem is, in the fallout of this, there have been numerous people, who have talked about trying to submit complaints against members to the ethics committee and being discouraged or flat out denied. These complaints never even made it to the ethics committee. People on the ethics committee have been speaking out about this too. The people who determine what gets sent to the ethics committee are apparently the RWA staff. So yes, systemic problems. Why did this particular complaint against this particular person get to the committee when others did not? And if we're following the rules and the letter of the law, well, obviously we're not. So that was a ridiculous thing to say. As part of the complaint, the author of the book in question, which features, and I haven't read this book, full disclosure, I've only read the clips that were online, but apparently it features Chinese characters. The main character is half Chinese. Courtney Milan is also half Chinese. So part of her calling it out was, you know, very personal to her about the perpetuation of these stereotypes to which she has been victimized by. Stereotypes like Asian women being subservient, exoticized, things like that. The author's response was that her book was written in the 1990s and is historically accurate, which makes it, quote, both immune from and irrelevant to current judgments of racist literature. She also cited her many degrees and her years of research on China and her New York Times bestseller status, among other things. The white woman who made the complaint, one of them used the words neo-Nazi in describing Courtney Milan, who is, as I stated before, a woman of color. Something like her being the chair of the ethics committee was like putting a neo-Nazi in charge of the UN. So this is where their heads were at. But I think it's useful to have, to at least think about the question of what is racism and who gets to decide. Because when you have an organization that has to be ruled by bylaws and statutes that can then be turned against people, I think it's a worthy discussion to have. Also, because in the aftermath of this, a lot of a lot of stories and personal experiences are coming out. People are posting about things that have happened in local chapters and other experiences with the staff and the board. And some of them are appalling and shocking. You know, we tend to look back when things happen like this, and things we thought maybe were odd at the time get looked at in a new light because there's no faith in the organization. There's no faith in the staff. And so you look back and say, was that just incompetence or was it racist? Was it homophobia? Or was it just a weird decision? It's like, you know, as a Black person, there's always this calculus when something happens. Were you seated in the back next to the kitchen in this restaurant because it was the only seat open, or was it racism? You know, was it bad service? Were they just an asshole, or is it racism? And you don't know. It's just always this question, and it's kind of like a self-gaslighting where you're just wondering. That's how a lot of this works. So when you have a preponderance of stories like this, then it leads to legitimate questions about what the hell is going on and what was going on in each of these incidents that, you know, point to larger issues with the decision making, with the processes, with things not being applied uniformly. At the same time, I'm disheartened in general by the way that the internet and sort of the modern, this era that we're in, prohibits us from having real conversations with people that we disagree with. Everything becomes a polemic, you know. We silo ourselves in our own echo chambers with people who agree with us, and people who disagree with us get dragged, and there's not time and space for discourse. I don't see how democracy works if you can't talk to people that you don't agree with, and that you can't have meaningful conversations with people with whom you disagree. Then again, how do you have a meaningful conversation with someone who has an inability to see the harm that they are causing? I don't expect institutions to be racist-free because racism is so baked into every institution, because it's baked into our country. I was listening to the 1619 podcast earlier this week or last week, and it's the one by the New York Times for the 1619 Project, which is basically talking about the legacy of slavery and how integral it was to the creation of this country, to the American Revolution, to America's rise as a superpower, to our economic growth built on free labor. So it's little wonder that there's systemic racism in every aspect of American culture and society and in every organization. So that doesn't mean that it's acceptable, but it means we have to acknowledge that it exists and that there any large group of people is going to contain a large group of people. And statistically, some of them are going to be racist. And I don't know how you get them out. A lot of people are leaving RWA over this. A lot of people are announcing their intention not to renew their memberships. They're actively canceling their memberships, withdrawing submissions from the Rita Awards, resigning from various committees. And I understand. So I wanted to talk about my decision, because when I first found out about this on Tuesday, the day before, was it Monday? On Monday, Christmas Eve Eve, I read the initial tweets and my first reaction was, oh, am I going to have to leave RWA? I like my chapter. I have benefited a lot from RWA, and I've talked about that before. I've benefited from my local chapter, and I'm active in my local chapter. We just had our local elections, and I have two positions in my local chapter that I'm committed to. I also just renewed with the national chapter in November. People are saying that they are able to get refunds for certain things. But CIMRA, which is the multicultural chapter of RWA, has moved to begin the process to recall the current president of the board and to have new elections. And you can only vote on that if you are a member in good standing. And so I've seen a lot of people who initially were canceling their membership, trying to uncancel or stick around so that they can vote on this. My position right now is that I'm not resigning as of today, December 28th, 2019. I want to see what happens. People are saying, oh, resign, start something new, because RWA can't be fixed. Maybe it can be fixed and maybe it can't, but starting something new, there's no guarantee that that new thing won't have its own issues. In fact, there is a guarantee that the new thing will have its own issues, because every group has its own issues. RWA has lost a lot of trust. The reputation of the organization is in ashes right now, but it's also a 30-year-old organization that apparently has $3 million in assets, that has reach and history and things that a new organization will absolutely not have for a very long time. So I think it makes most sense to me to see if it can be saved and salvaged and rebuild the trust, as opposed to walking away completely and starting something new. It's incredibly difficult to start an organization like this. And so, yeah, everybody needs to do what they have to do. For some people, it's just too much, and people are very emotional about it. And I understand that. I'm not emotional about it. I don't expect my organizations to be racism free. For me to put myself in a majority white situation is difficult. You know, when I walked into my first RWA meeting, I hadn't self-selected a majority white situation like that in a very long time. So I knew what I was getting myself into. And I felt that the benefits outweighed the discomfort, outweighed the microaggressions that I knew were going to occur, because I've been Black in America my whole life. Which is not to say that it's acceptable. It's to say that it's reality. And this is the country that we live in and the world that we live in. So I don't have any illusions about groups and organizations. So my decision has been to stay and see what happens. As long as I'm a member, I can vote. As long as I'm a member, I can make my voice heard. I'm not a joiner in general. I don't like joining things. I've talked about that before. And I also don't like quitting things. And especially when emotions are high, when there's not a lot of information out there, when we don't really even know everything that's happened. So that's my decision. And so I come full circle to this idea of what is racism and who gets to decide. When I was talking to my family about the situation over Christmas, because it was extremely top of mind, because obviously, and I was explaining how Courtney Milan had been suspended for basically calling a book racist online, several people were like, well, was the book racist? And that's both an important question and a completely irrelevant question. She felt that it was, and it was very personal to her. And even if it hadn't been personal to her, that was her opinion, and she is entitled to it. I'm sure you could find people who felt that it wasn't. Obviously, the author didn't feel like it wasn't. But I'm sure you could find Asian people, half Chinese people, people who had the same background as both Courtney and the characters in the book, who might not have felt that it was racist. We're not a monolith. We don't all think alike. You know, no matter what group you're a part of, you're going to have your own opinions. And so someone speaking from their heart, talking about something that hurt them, if it doesn't hurt someone else, it doesn't, you know, that's not really relevant. On the other hand, I've been seeing a lot of things called racist that are extremely questionable. I saw someone, there was a list where someone wrote that describing Black people with food words is racist. I'm sure there are Black people that agree with that. I'm one of the Black people that does not agree with it. I think there are definitely contexts where, you know, food words shouldn't be used, but I don't think that it's inherently racist. I've seen people say that, I think I've talked about this before, you should never use the word savage in a book. There's certain words you should never use. I don't agree with that. I think that we are seeing books coming out that are extremely sanitized, that have nothing of interest in them, in an effort not to offend anyone. You can't create art in a situation like that. If I give you a list of words that you cannot use because you fear they might harm someone, I think that's a terrible precedent and a very slippery slope. I think if you're going to use certain words, you need to understand what you're doing. You need to understand how they've been used and their history and how they might affect people. But just to whole cloth say, never use this word, I personally think that is extremely detrimental to art. I'm brought back to the quote that is on a sticky note on my computer by Haruki Murakami. It says, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. No one promised you a pain-free life. If you read a word in a book and it offends you and causes you pain, in my opinion, that's just part of existing. We're not going to have a pain-free existence. And we shouldn't expect to have one because it's unrealistic. So what is racist and who gets to decide? Apparently, the people who brought the complaint against Courtney accused her of being racist against them, this quote-unquote reverse racism, because they were white. So in situations like this, where you have a diverse group of people with differing opinions, how do you keep that same energy? How do you evaluate the legitimate from the spurious? Because I will acknowledge that I have selected a Twitter feed that is only really showing one side, and I've chosen not to engage in a place where I know that the other side is. I'm not saying that I'm not a hypocrite, but I don't want that. I don't have time for all of the foolishness, just part of the foolishness, right? But it's very indicative of our country, this particular situation, this question. White people legitimately feel like they are under attack. And legitimate in the fact that they actually feel that. Not that I believe that feeling is legitimate. And people of color and other marginalized people are actually, in many cases, under threat of harm, physical harm, financial harm. Not just emotional, mental, the list goes on and on of the ways that racism and discrimination have real life effects on our real lives. The complaint claims that the author of the book lost a publishing contract because of the accusations of racism against her. So they're claiming that they are also feeling some level of effect from fallout of their own behavior and of things that they did. And that's where I think we can look. Is it something that a system has done to you and to people like you? Or is it something that you have done that other people are commenting on, that other people are bringing to light and asking for a reckoning from you on? Is it a system in place that ensures your subjugation? That is part of what racism actually is. Racism requires power. Racism requires a system in place to implement policies that are discriminatory. If you don't have power, you can't be racist. Will anyone be able to convince this woman that her degrees and her New York Times bestseller status don't inure her from writing something that is racist? It is doubtful. Should we try to convince her? Is that something that anyone should take on as a duty? I think that's also doubtful. The point I just made a few seconds ago, you need power to be racist. I've heard the argument from people on the right. Well, Obama was president. He had power. Does that mean he can't be racist? The complaint cited that Courtney has a large following on social media. And so I think they were equating that to a level of power so that her words in their minds had consequences. If Courtney Milan is punished for violating the Be Nice to People clause in the bylaws by pointing out racism, what do we do about that? How do we protect legitimate calls for change and for awareness and for shining a light on something that is harmful? How do we protect from accusations of reverse racism? I don't know. I don't have the answer. I do know that I'm very wary of things that play out on Twitter. I'm very wary of conspiracy theories. I'm wary of the guessing and the assigning of blame and the reactions, the immediate reactions, especially when so much is unknown and so much is speculation. I'm wary of the virtue signaling, of people commenting just so they're on record as having the moral high ground, as trying to be seen as good people. I'm wary of a lot of things. And I'm wary of organizations. I'm wary of systemic racism. I'm wary of systemic homophobia and sexism. I'm wary of people who believe they're right and refuse to step down from positions once they've lost the trust of the people they're supposed to be representing. I'm wary of arrogance and groupthink and mob mentality, however it shows up. Those are my thoughts, and that's how I've been reacting, and it's been incredibly distracting. I have this urge to know what's going on, and I have an urge just to throw it all away, you know? I mean, I don't blame the people who just left and walked away, and it's like, I have books to write, because it's hard. It's hard to focus on other things. And the fact this happened over Christmas, I feel for the board members who resigned. I feel for Courtney. Courtney Milan is one of my favorite authors. The first time I met her in person, I fangirled all over her. I got the chance to hang out with her. And I know that the things that she does and that she says are done at great personal cost to herself and because she really believes that she has to. I mean, I can't speak for her, obviously, but from her actions, I truly believe that that she feels that this is the work she needs to be doing. And she's done so much work for inclusion and diversity and equality within the organization. She talks about how she's at a great personal cost to herself, both just in mental and emotional energy and in actual dollars. She hasn't published as many books, and she gets a lot of abuse online from various quarters. And so I'm really sorry that this happened to her. People do the things that they feel they need to. And it doesn't come without great cost. You know, RWA is a big part of a lot of people's lives. It's a much bigger part in many people's lives than it is in mine, honestly. And so I understand the emotional value of this and how painful the situation has been. But the suffering is optional. And I try to live my life that way. And I also try to be positive and create positive energy in my mind and in my space. And I actually, one of the people who talked about an incident that they had been a part of was Piper Drake, aka PJ Schneider, who was a member of Maryland Romance Writers. And she posted about an incident several years ago when we were at a board meeting. And Piper is Ty, and Piper is her pen name. And so her real name, which I don't remember, I don't know her by that name, but we were at a restaurant at this board meeting. And when, you know, we pay individually for our meals, and someone saw her credit card and her real name, and it was a white woman, and made a comment about her name sounding like a cough. That's the part that I remember. And apparently someone else said that they would never name their child something so un-American. And honestly, I didn't even hear that part because I think I was still enraged by the woman who said that her name sounded like a cough and was just dismissive and making fun of this woman's name. So when people show you who they are, I'm actually grateful. I knew who that woman was. And for the rest of our interaction, however long she was active on the board, I didn't forget who she was. I hear and listen to what people say, and it tells me a lot about them. And part of me is grateful to know. People show you who they are. Listen and believe them. Maybe that is the positive that I can find in the situation, that you can see who people are. And you can make decisions about whose books to buy and whose books not to buy. And, you know, I don't remember all of the people. I don't go into some of the places where people are really showing their ass online, but it trickles down. So you see who people are and take that information and move forward with it. And so a lot of people are being revealed. And I think that's ultimately the positive that I'm choosing to draw from the situation at the moment. And I hope that we can reclaim and save the organization because of its history, because of the good work that it has done. And maybe that good work has not been across the board. It has not been as equitably distributed as it should be. But it can be, I think. I hope. These are my thoughts and just what's been going through my mind as this whole thing has been unfolding. You may not agree, and that's fine. Please feel free to leave me a comment if you would like to. If you have another perspective, if you think I've missed something, there was a lot more going on than I wanted to go into, and still trying to keep this relatively short. But yeah, it's just what I've been thinking about. So thanks for listening to part one, and I hope you will join me in part two for my 2019 recap coming up.